Let us now look at Jesus in his environment. It is evident that some people at the time thought of Jesus as the Christ. Confused as they might have been, whatever thoughts they had, as I've already explained, their messianic hopes, one can't doubt that that was around. And I'll now hit you with very clear evidence from the Gospels. Right at the end, Jesus' death is the key textual evidence. In Luke 23:2, we read the people saying that Jesus, they want to condemn him to death because he was inciting our people to revolt, opposing tribute to Caesar and claiming to be Christ a king. Now, I know that's written many years later by Luke and taking them, but that plus all the other bits I'm giving you make it very obvious that even if they wanted to reject it, they were rejecting him as the Christ. But they certainly thought of him in those terms, or thought other people were thinking of him in those terms. The crucial question put to Pilate by the Jew, put to Jesus by Pilate is, "Are you the King of the Jews?" He didn't want a revolt in his hands. He didn't want a Messiah appearing, and Jesus was certainly someone that the crowds followed. So it entered their mind that maybe he's this rabble-rouser Messiah person. "Are you or aren't you?" says Pilate. When the soldiers mocked him in that little game, "Hail, King of the Jews," they said, you know, cynically. What a king, you know, "Hail, King of the Jews." The crowd, "Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross." That's what they were throwing at him. Why? Why would they throw that at him? Unless there was some association. And the key of it all is, in Roman law, when a person was killed on a cross, which was just an upright with a beam at the top of it, that's all. It was a T cross. A beam was carried by the person. The upright was already in the ground, well lodged. And they just kind of hoisted him up on it and fitted it in and then just whacked a couple of nails through it or something. Well, that above the T had to be put, in the language of the people, the crime that he'd committed. And all of the Gospels universally have Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. So, no doubt, Jesus was killed because he was accused of claiming to be king. So there's an association there, obviously. But even before his death, so we're going right back to Psalm, there are indications through the Gospel that people thought of him in this, somehow in this way. For example, John 1:49, we find Nathanael addressing him as the King of Israel. In John 6:15, the crowds after the multiplication of loaves, we're told, were about to take him by force and make him king. In the Synoptic Gospels, the blind man calls him Son of David. Matthew presents the crowd of being astonished at his teaching, and the comment is, "Can this be the Son of David?" Now, they're just a few little comments through there, but they seem to mirror in the Gospels a mentality that of the time where this question, and it almost inevitably would arise, about a charismatically endowed person like Jesus. I want to look with you at three really critical texts which make this point and clarify in what way at the time he was thought of as Christ. Because the key point I want to make to you is that Jesus never ascended a throne. Kingship means throne, it means power, it means dominant authority. The Jesus of the Gospel was not associated with that ever. The only throne he ever ascended in their image was the throne of heaven. So the 500 times that Jesus is called Christ in the New Testament, 490 of them refer to the risen Christ. We're not going to do that tonight. That's not our concept. So Christ, the Christ, means right across the board, means the risen, powerful, enthroned, exalted Jesus in heaven. That's not what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about when he was alive. In what way did his disciples think of him as the Christ? And in what way did he perhaps think of himself in those terms? Well, here's the evidence, and I think it points in a very clear direction. The first text is Caesarea Philippi. where in that watershed, that central point of the synoptic account of Jesus' ministry, Jesus says, "Who do you say I am?" And Simon Peter spoke up. I'm giving you Matthew's text. Simon Peter spoke up, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus replied, "Simon, you are blessed, because it was not flesh and blood that revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. So I now say to you, you are Peter," Kephas in their language, rock, Petros. "And on this rock," Petra in Greek, Kephas, same word in Hebrew, "on this rock," and it doesn't mean rock stone, it means bedrock. It means basic foundation, not a gibber, a basic foundation stone on which the earth kind of rests, bedrock is the word. "On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades," the gates of hell, the gates of death, not Gehenna, "the gates of death can never hold out against it." Then it goes on a bit. "He gave instructions not to tell anyone that he was the Christ." Now there's a lot in that, so I'll take you through it a little slowly. I'll remind you first of the oracle of Nathan and then put this back here. The oracle of Nathan, the original promise made to David, there were three things that the Christ King would do. He would be the Son of God, in the sense they understood that, eh? His throne would last forever, and he would build a house for God. Got that? And now look again at this text. There they are. The Christ is the Son of God, now in a way that transcends all the hopes of Israel, and we've looked at that a little already. Secondly, the gates of Hades will not hold out against the kingdom of this king. It's a dynasty that will go even beyond death. Death won't stop it. So it's... And he will build the house. And he's going to build the house of God, this king, this Christ, on the bedrock of this community, Peter, the rock. He's going to build it there. And the bedrock is the Kahal Yahweh, the sacred temple of the people of God built on this rock. So Matthew, at any rate, is quite clearly reflecting the traditional hopes attached to this Christ from the prophecy of Nathan. Admittedly, he's writing this many years later, so one has to take that into consideration as well. But the Gospels are not, as I go back to my very first lecture with you, the Gospels aren't just painting their own imaginative pictures out of the Gospel, out of what happened to Jesus. What they see is happening as further reflection simply unfolds what their memory and their intuitions at the time kind of held, like it does with us. We have an experience and there's more to it than we can grab, and then our later experience enables us to find words for that. But they're being faithful to the real Jesus, even though later concepts have clarified and later reflections have helped them find the words. They're going back to the authentic Jesus and the way they kind of touched and held and knew him at the time. So here, this text, however much later reflections are kind of held in it, is going back to that image and reflecting perhaps the way in which Jesus accepted. But he knew, he didn't want people to tell them they were the Christ, because he didn't want to be misunderstood. He accepted the title Christ in a very specific way, a way that made sense to him, because his kingdom of God was very different from what they were hoping for. He understood the Christ as, yes, in those terms. He goes on immediately, I hope that's clear enough, after that Caesarea Philippi event, where he's called the Christ by Peter, he goes on immediately, as we did when we looked at the Son of Man, to define Christ in terms of the Son of Man and the suffering servant, which we've looked at already. He says, you will be the Son of Man at the last day of judgment, etc. And he talks about himself as the suffering servant in those terms. So Jesus is the Christ. The temple he's going to build is the temple of people, community, built on the bedrock. It will fulfill the hopes made there, but it's identification again with the poor. It's, oh well, this other text puts it very beautifully. There's a quick second text. Matthew 11, 2-6 is unique in this, again Matthew, where he has a very interesting text where John in prison, that's John the Baptist, says, heard, and he's got the words there, the works of the Christ. He heard about the works of the Christ. And in other words, what the Christ is to do, and what are the works? This building a house for God, that's the main work. How did Jesus build God's house? What was the house he was building? The text goes on, John says, are you the one who is to come that we're hoping for? Or do we wait for someone else? And Jesus answered, go back and tell John what you hear and see. No theory, just tell him what you hear and see. The blind see again. These are the works of the Christ. The blind see again, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised to life, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is the one who does not lose faith in me. They're the works of the Christ. That is building a house for God. Building the Redeemer, God's people, into a holy people. And the Son of Man, the suffering servant, we're right back with that imagery again. That's the way he is anointed to do that. The second new really important text, which pretty well does the same thing. It's taken from Matthew. I've taken Matthew's text again, though it's the same in Mark. Matthew 21, 5-13 is after a messianic rally, is all you can call it, when Jesus comes into Jerusalem for the first time in the Synoptic Gospels. It hasn't been mentioned before. And then Jesus comes in, and all the excitement of coming to God's holy city and all that, and you know we do it on Palm Sunday, where the palms are put out and they're saying Hosanna to the King of David, and it's the psalm sung when the king enters into the temple. It's all traditional, but it's real messianic rally stuff. And so you're definitely, Jesus is being portrayed, and he comes in, Zechariah, on a foal of a donkey. The king, your king will come to you, says Zechariah. It's quoted by Matthew and again by John. Jesus very self-consciously taking on the role of a Messiah. Now he's a prophet. He knows what he's doing. You don't enter Jerusalem on a donkey with Zechariah's prophecy hovering over you about the Messiah coming into the temple. Jesus is not doing that without thinking, oh, I didn't realize. He's obviously terribly well aware of it. So we're into Jesus' own self-identity again. He chose a prophetic action which said very clear things to people, but he wants to interpret those things in his own way. And so the text goes on. Look, your king comes to you, humble, riding on a donkey. The crowds were shouting, Hosanna to the Son of David, blessings on him who comes in the name of Yahweh. Jesus went into the temple and drove out all who were selling and buying there. My house will be called a house of prayer. A real turnover of the prophecies, a complete reversal of expectation, because their expectations, put clearly in the same prophecy of Zechariah, 6:13, that talks about the mule, the same. That prophecy was, he will rebuild the sanctuary of Yahweh. They were expecting the Messiah to go in and rebuild this magnificent place for God. What does Jesus do? He goes in and he empties it. Mark tells us he refused to allow anyone to go through the temple anymore. The fig tree that was the symbol of Israel, that was at the time of the Messiah was going to flourish in beautiful fruit and be a symbol of wealth and prosperity and in through the land, What does Jesus do to the fig tree? Curses it, withered, because it was all leaf, no fruit. What kind of fruit is he interested in? What kind of church is he in? Kahal Yahweh, community. John's comment on that same clearing of the temple right back at the beginning of his gospel, so you're getting in touch with New Testament kind of thoughts that were playing around in people's mind. John 2:18-21, when he emptied the temple, they said, "What sign can you give us to justify what you've done in clearing the temple? Instead of building the house of God, you've cleared it. What?" And he says, "Destroy this sanctuary, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And John comments, he was speaking of the sanctuary that was his body. Build the house of God. It's something to do with humanity. It's something to do with the Word was made flesh. It's something to do with the body of man and the body of woman. And that saying, "Destroy this sanctuary, in 3 days we will raise up," is certainly a saying of Jesus, because it comes back in, you know, different places. Like, you remember in the Synoptic Gospels, that's the accusation thrown at Jesus at the trial. He said he would destroy the temple and raise it up in 3 days. And that's in a totally different setting, in a totally different tradition. So we're in touch with an authentic saying of Jesus. It would be the only sensible conclusion from all that. And here John associates it with the clearing of the temple. John, the symbolist, the one who can see the basic meaning, that the temple is now different. The house that he's going to build is going to be to do with humanity, with the body. And you'll find Paul, won't you, developing this thesis later when he talks about marriage as the temple, the sacrament, that two shall be one, and so on. The whole sacredness of the community, and so on, as the house, the temple, built on Peter. So there is a scene with the Christ again, building the house of God. But the sacred place is now ordinary, broken humanity. The blind, the lame, the poor, built into a community of love. The kingdom is a kingdom of love, justice, peace. Thirdly and finally, on this particular aspect, the trial, which I've vaguely mentioned, but it's good to note the same three factors again, or two of them anyhow are there. At the trial, again giving you Matthew 26:61-4, a key text of the Christ, two stepped forward and made a statement. "This man said, I have power to destroy the temple of God," there it is, "and in 3 days build it up." He goes on to say, but even they got confused and couldn't agree, you know. And then when the final key question comes, the high priest said to Jesus, "I put you on oath by the living God to tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." Right back to the prophecy of Nathan. He's not thinking in any profound ontological terms. He's thinking of the King Christ, who is the promised one and the Son of God. "Are you the Messiah?" And Jesus' response is interesting. In Mark, he simply says, "I am." Matthew is more nuanced, and Matthew says, "The words are your own." It's almost like, if that's what you want to call me, you call me. That's okay, fine. They're your words. But he goes on to give his words. "The words are your own. Moreover, I tell you, from the time onward you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven." Remember, we did that a couple of weeks ago. Jesus' words, if we're going to call him Christ, the perfume of God, the one who's going to effect the reign of God, then he's insisting the only way he can identify with such a big, big, big title is if people mean that he's on about bringing about the holiness of people in their body, their life, their real human existence, and as one who reveals from God through identification with the poor and the outcasts and the lowly and the ordinary folk, God's love. It's a little, tiny, gentle, powerful way, but that's what he means by it. He's not into thrones. I hope that's clear to you. And now just a few concluding remarks. This title which we're looking at tonight, or this concept of Christ, is in one of the key touchstones of orthodoxy in the New Testament. But I want to remind you that what we're talking about is not that an orthodox person will say Jesus is Christ and therefore be right. That isn't the point. Orthodoxy is saying that Jesus is the Christ. That whatever thoughts we have about the Christ, and there were plenty of them around at the time, and there are plenty today, I presume, whatever equivalent concepts we might have. Orthodoxy was to say that all those fantastic dreams that we talked about today are realized in Jesus, the real Jesus that we're talking about. Who is Jesus? That's the one. So we don't, what we often do in theology terribly, and I think it's tragic, is we take Jesus and fit him into all the great concepts we've got. The Christ. Oh, Jesus is the Christ. Sounds fantastic. We've got another big concept about him, another big concept. And we take Jesus and he gets unrecognized after a while. Whereas the process is entirely the other way around. Jesus is the one they knew. Jesus is the one they lived with. Jesus is the one who died on a cross. Jesus is the one who was humble and gentle. Jesus is the one who confronted the injustice of his day. Jesus is the one whose lifestyle was something they had full of memories of and stacks of. They knew him. They couldn't understand all about him. Who does? But they knew him. And the faith these people had was that he is the Son of Man. He is the suffering servant. He is the prophet. He is the Christ. So this big thing becomes not as big, perhaps, more beautiful, more real, more touching, more present. He is the perfume of God. And he was never near a throne. He never exercised power like that. He didn't bawl in the street as he was the throne. Well, the only throne he's going to ascend on earth is the cross. So whatever that says, is have to redefine our terms. Well, here it is anyhow. Mark 1:1, the beginning of the good news about Jesus Christ. And one text, one set of texts has the Son of God, other texts don't. It's a disputed original text, not all that clear. But certainly they all have Christ in. John, now that's the first verse of Mark, the first verse of the first gospel is about him as the Christ. Here, John, end of his gospel, exactly the same. These signs are recorded, his gospel, so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. Eh? See where you've got to put the, I believe you must put the accent, the Son of God, and that believing this you may have life through his name. John 2:22, the first letter of John, the one who denies that Jesus is the Christ is a liar, he is anti-Christ, and he's denying the Father as well as the Son. This Jesus is all that our hopes, all that our dreams, all that we looked at earlier, all those promises made by God have been realized in a way that totally transcended anything the prophet could have imagined, beautifully transcended in Jesus. But well, I don't want to make that a big statement. We've really got to focus the statement to see what does it mean, and the only way we can see what it means is by actually looking at Jesus. That's why I put the text there to John the Baptist. The blind see, the lame walk. And that is what it's about. Finally, 1 John 5:1, whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ has been begotten by God. And the place that they take us to look at what it means, where does the perfume of God come from? It's the cross. Where do we see? Where do we fill up our senses with God? It's in that one who identified like the Son of Man, with the poor and the outcast and the lonely and the dejected and whatever, and made God's love real for ordinary people. He is the one who suffered through infidelity. He's the one who gave his life to show God's love, and it was the perfume of that love that filled up people's senses, from Mary Magdalene, Peter, Mary the mother, and all the rest. I'll conclude by reading for you from the Acts of the Apostles, because this just brings us into the picture a little. They're talking about Antioch. in the Acts chapter 11. And Antioch was an incredible experiment, really, where hard to imagine. I can't imagine us having the bravery to do it, locked as we are in so much ritual, law, habit, precious things, exactly the way Paul of Tarsus was and the Jews in Jerusalem were. They were absolutely cluttered with lovely laws, you know, about the temple and law and fasting and now. We know what Jesus did with a lot of that because his task was too important to be concentrating on those things. The early church captured the spirit of Jesus, and within a few years of Jesus' death you find Jews eating with Samaritans. I still find that incredible to believe, eh? Like, they hadn't done it for 500 years and then within about 2 years they're doing it. What accounts for that except something amazing like Jesus, eh? Who could make that possible? And then a couple of years later, heavens, Stephen's murdered and the group go out of Jerusalem. They must have been fired with an incredible vision of humanity and love and who God was, because then we find him in Antioch and we find Jews, Samaritans, non-Jews sitting down to a meal together and sharing the Eucharist. Part of me would think, how could they do it so quickly? They wouldn't have had enough theology. You might think that too. They didn't go through it a catechumenate, long enough to be able to do it. If they'd have waited for the catechumenate to end, the church would never go off the ground. Imagine Pentecost Sunday, entering all them up for a start in a baptismal register. Yeah. What next? But I mean, they couldn't, whether or not about that, but they couldn't. I mean, God, it was too big for that. They had more things to do. So, thank God. So Antioch was happening. It was a phenomenon, an extraordinary phenomenon. And it shocked the people in Jerusalem, because it's a big thing to do that. And here the text reads about Antioch. Barnabas left them for Tarsus to look for Saul. And when he found him, he brought him to Antioch. He wanted to get reinforcements. Get Saul, Paul would be a good bloke on side. So they've got Paul there, in there. As things turned out, they, that's Barnabas and Paul, were to live together in that church for a whole year, instructing a large number of people. It was at Antioch the disciples were first called Christians. Anointed ones. Because right from the beginning, not just that they were disciples of the Christ, that's part of the meaning, but the basic meaning is the anointed ones. Christians from the beginning, recognizing exactly what I hope I've communicated to you tonight, that the whatever they're going to anoint Bethel, let Bethel be anointed, let the tabernacle be anointed, let certain people, though the Christians weren't interested in this, set certain people aside for sacred tasks. That's all gone now. Jesus is the only priest. He's made the offering. We are all priests. The whole nation is sacred. So what we do now is, and we do it now with babies, which is very beautiful. A little baby is anointed. And now, just because it's receiving something, it's a sacred place where God dwells. We've all been anointed. We are Christians, anointed ones, because God has chosen to live with us. And our task, and it was seen by others to be that in a way, our task was not temple people, not church people, if you take the meaning of building, kind of, going to Mass on Sunday is a beautiful thing to do, but it's not the essential Christian act. The essential Christian act are the acts of the Christ, the effecting of the kingdom of God in the world, the being an anointed temple of God to bring the perfume of God into the world. Now, to do that, we need the risen Christ. We need the nourishment for the journey. We need the Eucharist. We need the community. All those beautiful things, I didn't want to take from them, they're totally beautiful. But a practicing Christian, a practicing Catholic, ought to be defined, I believe, as one who is doing the works of the Christ. That's a practicing Catholic. Now, a practicing Catholic will want to, need to, and love to celebrate that in a Eucharist and be nourished from the table, nourished from the altar, nourished from the cross. You won't do it for very long if you're not, as Jesus says, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you won't. You can't live. But the life is, I don't want to make a speech out of this, but I mean, I think the indications of tonight's lecture lead that way, and I want to leave you with that thought of your own consecration, that you and I are Christians, anointed ones. And thanks to the beautiful life of Jesus and the beautiful parents we had, we've been consecrated. A statement has been made about us, and God's promise, he will never go back on his promises. God has effected something very beautiful in you and me. And so our only task is to take that. Remember that that's what we're taking when we meet each other in any relationship. And that puts an end, surely, to all the horrors that we do in all kinds of religious names, you know, the way we treat each other and defend. Or, there's a lot of things you can't do if that's what you're on about. And there's a lot of things Jesus couldn't do. But I hope you take my basic point. When we talk about Christ the King, if we say Christ the King and push it up high, we can become triumphalist, we can become powerful people, we can become enthroned in strong positions, we can do a whole lot of hateful bloody things that have nothing to do with the gospel. The only way Christ accepted the term King, Christ, was God's reign, the perfume of God, and where they found him was not on a throne, not in a triumphal position, but the suffering servant, loving and taking the consequences of his love, finally having his life taken away because he loved. But that's what they remembered, and that's why they called him the Christ.